I'm Christopher Leiden. This is Open Source from the Watson Institute at Brown University. An American conversation with global attitude, we call it. This one is the first try with a hip-hop key to open up this age of Obama. We've been open sourcing on the black prophetic tradition, on the church and civil rights striving that shaped Barack Obama. Affirmative action helped secure his education in a black studies boom on campus, influential, all of it. But what is the leverage of the pervasive pop culture of the same three decades in the rise of Barack Obama? What is the formative power of that rhyming, rhythm-driven rap testimony that spread from the South Bronx in the 1970s to a hip-hop nation over 30-some years? What is the resonance now of that culture and a hurting world? First up in our hip-hop conversation, and there will be other angles, is Adam Bradley, who may be hip-hop's best friend in the high culture tier. Adam Bradley's fascinating argument for hip-hop as art is titled Book of Rhymes, The Poetics of Hip-Hop. Adam Bradley himself had a biracial, two-tier boyhood in Salt Lake City. His grandmother force-fed him Shelley and the English Romantic poets. His brother introduced him to the rough rappers of the 80s and 90s, like N.W.A. and Biggie Smalls. In his Ph.D. studies at Harvard, Adam Bradley dug deep into Ralph Ellison's masterwork, the novel Invisible Man. But he kept listening to the musical news from the street. I asked Adam Bradley what it means to see President Obama as a child of hip-hop.
Obama is a man of parts, to use Ralph Ellison's term. And undoubtedly one of those parts comes from hip-hop. We saw it on the campaign trail. Think of that moment when he's speaking before the crowd, when he's being besieged. This is in the primary season, being besieged by attacks both implicit and explicit from his rival. And what does he do? He dusts off his shoulder. In the tradition of Jay-Z, get that dirt off your shoulder, that gesture. Mm. You know, in some ways, I think Jay-Z and Barack Obama provide interesting foils for one another. And I actually have thought a number of ways that they link up in ways that maybe neither of them would understand. And I think it's fitting that Jay-Z had such good seats at the inauguration. And I think that's not by happenstance.
Explain it to them as well as to us.
Well, it starts with swagger. Now, this is a term that's so big in hip-hop circles. Swagger or swag is a way of being. Jay-Z has this line that I was thinking about. You know, he says, check out my swag, yo. I walk like a ball player. No matter where you go, you are what you are, player.
Thing ain't lie, I done came through the block and everything that's fly. I'm like Che Guevara with bling on, I'm complex. I never claim to have wings on, nigga, I get my by any means on. Whenever there's a drought, get your umbrellas out because that's when I brainstorm. You can blame Sean, but I ain't inventing the game. I just rolled the dice trying to get some change. And I do it twice, ain't no sense in me lying as if I am a different man. And I could blame my environment, but ain't no reason why I be buying expensive chains. Hope you don't think users are the only abusers. Niggas getting high within the game. If you do, then how would you explain? I'm 10 years removed, still a vibe is in my veins. I got a hustler spirit, nigga, period. Check out my hat, yo, peep the way I wear it. Check out my swag, yo, I walk like a ball player. No matter where you go, you are what you are, player. And you can try to change, but that's just the top layer. Man, you was who you was before you got here. Only God can judge me, so I'm gone. Either love me or leave me alone.
And I think about Obama just in the cadence, not only of his speech, but also in the ways that he actually physically moves, the way he walks to a podium. The way he addresses a crowd, the gestures, that everything from the shoulder brush to his stride. These are things that within the tradition are immediately recognizable to us.
Fascinating. And you haven't used the word flow yet. I mean, if flow hadn't been invented, it would have been invented around Obama, just the way he walks in a way.
Oh, no doubt. No doubt about it. And you know that flow is so essential to certainly the lyrical element of hip-hop culture. It's the essence of it, the relationship of a voice to a beat. And with Obama, you almost feel like there's a beat going on in his head when he speaks. If you think about that speech in Denver, the awesome range of the crowd, the way that his voice filled that stadium, and the rhythms and cadences both drawn from the Black church through Dr. King, of course, but also, you know, drawn through Harvard, drawn through Kansas, drawn through a range of these associations that he brings, the cultures that he brings, this fusion of cultures that he represents in his very self.
Adam Bradley, your book is so compelling. I'm rewriting my whole sense of universal history in terms of hip hop and where we're at. In your own kind of review of the last 3, 4, 5 decades, give us a hip hopper's history of how we got here. For me, it always begins simultaneously with that famous New York Daily News headline, "Ford to City, Drop Dead," which meant to the South Bronx, I mean, you're dead already. And this was a kind of response. But where have we been and how did we get to this moment in 09, which you're calling a kind of hip-hop era, as well as a kind of age of Obama?
Well, I think about the words of KRS-One in describing hip-hop's origins. He said, "Hip-hop was the final conclusion of a generation of creative people oppressed with the reality of lack." And that idea of it, the final conclusion of a generation of creative people oppressed with the reality of lack, which is to me another way of asking, what does an artist do without an art form? And what do you do? Where does that energy go? We saw in the South Bronx that it often went toward violence, towards the various elements of gang culture that were created. But then with the creation of hip-hop, with the emergence of hip-hop, all of a sudden there's an art form with which to direct that creativity, whether it's into graffiti, to emceeing, whether it's b-boying or breakdancing, as it used to be called, or whether it's DJing. All of these things that would come to be known as the four elements of hip-hop, they took shape out of profound necessity. Now, of course, when we think about hip-hop, often the first thing we think about is rap, is the element of the lyrical element of it. And to me, that shares in a tradition that's much broader than rap itself, that stretches back in the African-American tradition through various forms of wordplay, whether it's the dozens, you know, signifying. Or
Muhammad Ali, for Muhammad example, Ali. The heavyweight champion of rap, somebody calls him.
That's right, Muhammad Ali, or profound way of characterizing that James Baldwin uses. He says that black language often emerges out of brutal necessity. You know, that phrase of brutal necessity, there's something about that. And yet on the other side, there's a playfulness. There's a celebration. Rap's first hit, Rapper's Delight, after all, was rhymed to the beat of Good Times, the disco hit that created out of that a sense of the party, but also a sense of protest, a sense of it being both rebel music and also music that'll get you on the dance floor. And this has always been a part of what rap is, and it traces it through the black world tradition. And to me, what I'm trying to do in this book is to say, in addition to that, we have to think of rappers as masters of the Western poetic tradition as well, and inheritors of it, inheritors of the tradition of William Shakespeare, and William Wordsworth, and Emily Dickinson, and Langston Hughes, inheritors of this grand tradition, who are taking from it and creating something with what's close to them, fashioning a new form, a new poetics, a revolution of the word.
You know, that sounds like a sell, and it was new to me, but your book makes it very compelling. I was reading along thinking, this is the way Helen Bender writes about Shakespeare and takes apart the sounds, the assonances, the consonances in the sonnets, for example, the repetitions, the inversions, all that technical stuff you call poetics. Can you give us an example of a rap lyric in which before you we didn't suspect that there was so much going on, or what was going on?
Well, first I have to admit my debt to Helen Vendler. In fact, she was one of my greatest teachers as a grad student, and I bear her influence as proudly as I possibly could, although I'm scared to have her read the book. But I did try to bring a Vendlerian sense to how to consider rapping on the level of language, on the level of sound, even on that level, and a lot of what I observe takes place in rhythm itself, even without words. That said, I mean, it's fun to talk about what happens on the level of wordplay, which is, I think, where rap becomes its most inventive. Just think about, for instance, this series of rhymes from a young rapper named Asher Roth. He's a young white kid, college kid, and he is of the tradition nonetheless. And he rhymes these three words that I don't think anybody in the history of rap would ever consider rhyming. It took someone coming from his particular background to come up with this. He rhymes Yiddish, spinach, and Quidditch from Harry Potter fame. And this is something that you're not going to hear from Rakim. You're not going to hear from Jay-Z, from Kanye West. It's a way that one of the things that I observe in the book is that one's context creates the poetic form. So you create your poetic world out of that which surrounds you. And in this case, with Asher Roth, we have an artist introducing something new, largely because his influences are distinct. The places where he grows up, the things that he sees are distinct. And so that embodies itself in his poetics. One other quick example to think about is one that's been heard over and over again the last year or so is from Lil Wayne, a song called Lollipop. And he has this remix version in which he says this, and excuse the pun. I mean, rap does a lot with puns, but here's the pun. He says something like this: safe sex is great sex. Better wear a latex, because you don't want that latex that I think I'm latex. And just the play of puns across the line. And I know that Helen Vendler, if she's listening, will say, puns are the lowest species of figurative language that are possible. And yet there's something so innovative in that. Puns have been in everything from Shakespeare to the Bible. And there's a way that puns can be endowed with, I think, great linguistic force. And what we see him doing with that pun, latex, and then late text, and then either late text again or late text, as in the name, whatever he's doing, and all of this being done while rhyming to a beat, staying on time, staying in the pocket of the beat, and making some sort of sense. Now, that's an awful lot to balance. That's an awful lot to juggle. And so part of the ingenuity of rap's poetics is not simply accessible on the page, but almost necessitating the performance itself. So I always recommend in looking at rap on the page, going back to the performance as well, listening to it, whether it's in your headphones or at a concert, which is the best venue, of course, that interplay of the written and the performed is always at the heart of what hip-hop poetics is about.
Why would she probably be the odd cookie in the plastic bag, about to get crushed by a building? I've flushed out the feeling of me being the shit, cause I was leaving skin marks on everywhere I sit. I am everywhere, I'm it, like hide and go, and I can go anywhere, any minute, mine and more. I'm in your neighborhood area, CD thing, tape deck, iPod, your girlfriend, and she say I got great sex, safe sex is great sex, better wear a latex, cause you don't want that latex that I think I'm latex. So wrap it up, but he's so sweet, she wanna let that rapper. Bottles in the club, shawty wanna.
I didn't know till I read the book. I somehow sensed it that you were a student of Helen Vendler. I did know that you're a great student of Ralph Ellison. what in the world would Ralph Ellison make of this art among, so to speak, his people?
Well, you know, I've given a great deal of thought to that, Chris. It's through Ellison that I've come to appreciate hip-hop as a student, even if,
really?
Yeah, even if Ellison himself would have never listened to Big Daddy Kane or LL Cool J or, you know, today Jay-Z or Kanye West, he makes me a better listener of them because of one key fact, and that's his sense of the vernacular, and particularly the idea of the vernacular process of taking that which is inherited or even foisted upon you, combining it with something close at hand to fashion a new form. So, for instance, I mean, think about jazz. Think about the birth of jazz. You have these cats sitting around on the corner, perhaps in New Orleans, and one of those European marching bands comes by, you know, with the oom-pa, oom-pa, you know, that kind of sound. They got the sax and the trumpet and everything, the trombone, and somebody says, I can do something with that. Mm-hmm. I can take that instrument and I can bend its sound. I can bend it to the shape of my own ears, to bend it to the shape of my own aesthetic. It's this powerful, powerful vernacular process at work. I think rap does the same. Two turntables and a microphone is all you need with rap to make it work. Not even that, a tabletop, pound out a beat, and have a voice rocking over that beat. To me, this is the essence of vernacular culture at work for our 21st century America. And I have no doubt that whatever else Ralph Ellison would have thought of rap, he would have had to have appreciated that. But what I would say to Ellison, if I had the opportunity, give me, y'all don't even need the two turntables, just give me a microphone. This is what I would say to him. I would say that hip hop culture, out of every musical culture around today, is the most preoccupied with craft, is the most preoccupied with excellence. And this is something that's often overlooked, because in the public arena, we often get to hear some of the worst that rap has to offer. But if you really want to face scrutiny, go to an open mic night where there are people competing in lyrical battles. Step into a cipher, you know, that circle of creative, collaborative, and competitive space where MCs apply their craft. Get into a cipher, and you'll see a judgment and discernment of the highest order at work. Mm. You know, people say that rap is, it's always in 4/4 time almost, and it has very little variability, very little going on in the level of harmony and melody, and yet one of the most profound insights into a case for limiting yourself as an artist comes from Derek Walcott, who said, you know, the mind thrives upon its limits. And he would know about the necessity of limiting oneself in order to find inspiration. So in poetry, maybe it's working within, you know, terse rima or writing in the sonnet form. Why does the sonnet survive for centuries upon centuries? There's something about the mind that wants its limits. In rap, it's the same thing. It just has a musical limit most often that it works with. Or, you know, the fact that rappers say new things in old ways and old things in new ways. This is something I learned by reading Shelley, who said, you know, that poetry at its best makes the familiar unfamiliar. You know, thinking about figurative language and how the function of figurative language works. But rap is that writ large. It takes the familiar and makes it unfamiliar. Even if it's just talking about girls and clothes and cars, there's still a way to create great poetry out of that.
Untouchable like Elliot Ness. The track hits your eardrum like a slug to your chest. Back a vest for your Jimmy in the city of sex. We in that sunshine state where the bomb ass him be. The state where you never find a dance floor empty and pimp speed. On a mission for them greens. Lean, mean, money making machines serving fiends. I've been in the game for 10 years making rap tunes. Ever since honeys was wearing Sassoon. Now it's 95 and they clock me in watch me diamond shining, looking like I'm Rob Liberace. It's all good, from Diego to the Bay. Your city is the bomb if your city making pay. Throw up a finger if you feel the same way. Straight putting it down for California, yeah.
Adam Radley, talk about the content of rap, which troubles a lot of people, including Barack Obama, yeah. not least. But the messages, the get rich or die trying, the sexism, all the bitch and hoe stuff. There's a kind of internal racism about it. Stanley Crouch, as you know, calls it Birth of a Nation with a Backbeat. It's profoundly contrary, not to mention the N-word. Where do you find a level of irony, a kind of protest, a kind of double reverse morality even in the rap content?
Well, Ellison is instructive here as well. He has a phrase that I know you'll know about, title of one of his great essays from Shadow and Act, I believe, called Change the Joke and Slip the Yoke. And there's a tremendous power in, you know, thinking particularly about the N-word, about taking that word and changing it, transforming it, putting it to a different set of uses. A couple of years ago, CNN had this documentary on it where they called, I think it was called Hip-Hop Art or Poison. And the thing about hip-hop, in my experience as a lifelong lover is that often its art comes with the poison. You have to take the poison with the art and ingest it in that way. Some people learn to reject that part and somehow to process it out of themselves. You could think about, for instance, feminist women whom I know who will hit the dance floor if the beat is right, regardless of what the song is saying. I guess one other thing I would add is that hip-hop is, as all art is, a reflection of our culture. And it is perhaps a powerful and audible expression of what our culture is, which is an increasingly violent, doggedly sexist, and consistently, I think, consumerist culture that we now reside in the early 21st century. Maybe things are shifting. Maybe this will be one of the ways that Barack Obama and his presidency, all of this energy that was built up, particularly among young people, around his campaign and around what some often think of as this vacuous idea of hope or an aimless idea of hope. Maybe it can find direction in part through the music. It can find direction, and with it give the music direction toward a way of bridging barriers, you know, crossing racial divides, crossing perhaps even generational divides. The reality that young people live in today, even I'm talking here about my students, I'm talking about 18, 19, 20-year-olds, is markedly different than the reality that I lived in as a 32, 33, 34-year-old. It's a very different thing. And one of the differences to me has to do with really an absorption of hip-hop's fundamental lesson, which is that if you have the skills, you're in. If you have the skills to participate in the culture, you're in. There's a way that hip-hop doesn't respect a lot of the boundaries that we have in our culture, for better and for worse. But one of the ways that it's for better is that it creates possibilities for building coalitions along lines other than the conventional ones of race and class and gender and the host of even nationality. You know, there is a hip-hop nation. There is a hip-hop nation that's out there, a global nation that crosses all of those boundaries. And what we do with it is still taking shape, is still coalescing. But nonetheless, there is something from which we can build, something that we can give direction to. Maybe Barack Obama will help.
I don't know what this world is coming to.
What's up, Missy? Timo. I came from the gutter, no, I came from my mother, but you know what I mean. Hope it's here to stay like permanent crease in your jeans. Me and Missy be the new tag team. Whoop, there it is. We like Ray and Go in showbiz. We public enemy number one. Our Uzi weighs a ton. This is a house run.
What happened to those good old days when hip hop was so much fun? Oh, house parties in the summer, y'all. And no one came through with a gun. It was all about good music, y'all. It helped to relieve some stress.
Hip-hop has become, in many, many ways, the universal culture. I mean, it's everywhere. To me, the fear about it and about Barack Obama is that they'd all turn out, in some long perspective, to have been about marketing, to have been about slickness, commercialism, consumerism, feel-good moments. Speak to that sort of dread, that it is all kind of an illusion.
Yeah. This is a major, major issue. And it's one of the ways that Barack Obama and hip hop share something in common. Barack Obama, from what I can tell and from what I've read, is a reluctant participant in this commodification of himself. When his advisors came to him with the idea of the whole yes we can motto, he was highly skeptical of it. Now, it ended up working quite, you know, even Pepsi has decided to jump on some of the Obama marketing bandwagon. It's working in that regard. But that said, I think there's something behind it in his.
You've heard this of Ben and Jerry's ice cream, yes, pecan.
I mean, this is a global phenomenon. I talk to my friends in far-flung places across the whole world, and people know the slogan. Hip-hop, it's easy to dismiss along those lines of being simply a product of its marketing. I mean, Jay-Z is the first to say, I'm not a businessman, I'm a businessman. That said, when you pull away the layers from hip-hop's consumer packaging, often what you find are essential elements of substance. Substance on the level, undoubtedly, of art.
Diamonds are forever. Throw your diamonds in the sky if you feel the vibe.
Diamonds are forever.
The rock is still alive every time I rhyme. Forever, ever, forever, ever, ever, ever. Still, people lose hands, legs, arms for real. Little was known of Sierra Leone and how we connect to the diamonds we own. When I speak of diamonds in this song, I ain't talking about the ones to be glown. I'm talking about Rockefeller, my home, my chain. These ain't conflict diamonds. Is they Jacob? Don't lie to me, man. See a part of me saying, keep shining. How? When I know where the blood diamonds. Though it's thousands of miles away, Sierra Leone connect to what we go through today. Over here, it's the drug trade. We die from drugs. Over there, they die from what we buy from drugs. The diamonds, the chains, the braces, the charms is. I thought my Jesus piece was so harmless. Till I seen a picture of a shorty armless. And here's the conflict. It's in a black person's soul to rock that gold. Spend your whole life trying to get that ice. On a polo rugby, you look so nice. How can something so wrong make me feel so right? Right? Before I beat myself up like Ike. You can still throw your Rockefeller diamond tonight. Because
diamonds are forever.
Throw your diamonds in the sky if you feel the vibe.
Diamonds are forever.
The rock is still alive every time I rhyme.
What's the chance that any of the rappers will be remembered 30, 40, 50 years on in anything like the way that Count Basie or Miles Davis or Charlie Parker have asserted themselves more and more into a tremendous tradition of American art.
This is a big question. When I think about the staying power of hip hop, and I think about a line that Andre 3000 of Outkast delivered on a song called "Hollywood Divorce" that came out a couple years ago, and he's talking about, well, what do we do when the music becomes so commodified, when it goes Hollywood? What happens to it? And he said, invoking, I like to think, Ezra Pound, when he said, make it new. Andre 3000 says, make new shit, quite simply. Make new shit. To me, that may be what it's going to take.
Starts off like a small town marriage. Lovely wife and life.
Hollywood come through my neighborhood with cameras on. I really think they're stealing from us like a sample song. I really wish one day we'd take it back like Hammer's home. The hurricane come and took my Louisiana home. And all I got in return was a darn country song. This old country wrong. Oh, but you right if you just put a little ice on and cut your mic on, but you don't even write songs. But Hollywood make you spit like a python. I make Cobra, I'm so not sober. I'm high like a Hollywood coffee or soda. You can call me a roller. Hold up, your grill's glistening. Spent $100,000 on mine to feel different. What's the real sense of it? Bling bling, I know. And did you know I'm the creator of the term? I just straightened the perm. They let it sit too long, they just making it burn. Make a movie of our lifestyle, but they earn like a dead body burned on the mantelpiece. That's why I try not to lie on wax like it's candle grease. And I beast a little nigga cooler than antifreeze. Defrost on your window pane, Lil Wayne. But in Hollywood it's Little Wayne. Don't make me numb, so that's why I got a prenum. I do.
Starts off like a small town marriage. Lovely wife and life, baby carriage.
Looking beyond what we've already seen in hip hop culture, drawing from it, drawing from the best of it, but also reshaping it into new forms. We see this with artists like MIA, for instance, the young artist from England who brings her own cultural inheritances from East Asia into her music and does it in nonetheless in a hip-hop vein that's recognizable around the globe. At the Grammys, she was on stage with Lil Wayne, Kanye West, Jay-Z, T.I., and she was rocking with the best. She was right there with them. To me, hip-hop is headed in this direction toward these new formulations that bring with it some of the old, but also in the vernacular tradition, grab onto the new, grab onto to what isn't already co-opted. And in that sense, I think we can anticipate artists who may well have this kind of cultural currency in the years to come. I don't know yet if we've had our Count Basie for hip-hop. I don't know. But I feel like with all this happening in music right now, one is soon to come.
I fly like Piper, get high like planes. If you catch me at the border, I got visas in my name. If you come around here, I'll make them all day. I get one down in a second if you wait. I fly like Piper, get high like planes. If you catch me at the border, I got visas in my name. If you come around here, sitting on trains, every stop I get to, I'm clocking that game. Everyone's a winner, we're making our fame. Bonafide hustler, making my name. Sometimes I think sitting on trains, every stop I get to, I'm clocking that game. Everyone's a winner, we're making our fame. Bonafide hustler, making my name.
In Book of Rhymes, your book, Adam, you quote great Papa Ellison, Ralph Ellison, and his definition of the blues. Would you read it and then explain in what degree rap meets that definition.
So it's this. The blues is an impulse to keep the painful details and episodes of a brutal experience alive in one's aching consciousness, to finger the jagged grain and to transcend it, not by the consolation of philosophy, but by squeezing from it a near-tragic, near-comic lyricism. As a form, the blues is an autobiographical chronicle, a personal catastrophe expressed lyrically. Now, to me, there's a way that within the hip-hop tradition, the blues expresses itself. It's only one of many strains, but it's there. It's there in artists like, you know, from many years ago now, the Ghetto Boys. They have a song called My Mind's Playing Tricks on Me. And here you have an artist named Scarface, who's still, you know, quite active from Houston, Texas, who's a blues man. He's a blues man. He's even maybe one of Amiri Baraka's blues people, I would say. And he says, you know, at night I can't sleep. I toss and turn, candlesticks in the dark, visions of bodies being burned. I mean, just a line like that is a powerful, powerful connection with the blues tradition that Ellison talked about. That is a tradition that goes down into the depths of experience, but with the idea of rising up, with the idea of transcendence.
At night I can't sleep, I toss and turn, candlesticks in the dark, visions of bodies being burned. Four walls just staring at a nigga. I'm paranoid, sleeping with my finger on the trigger. My mother's always stressing I ain't living right, but I ain't going out without a fight. See, every time my eyes close, I start sweating and blood starts coming out my nose. It's somebody watching the act, but I don't know who it is, so I'm watching my back. I can see him when I'm deep in the covers. When I awake, I don't see the motherfucker. He owns a black hat like I own, a black suit and a cane like my own. Some might say take a chill, B, but fuck that shit. There's a nigga trying to kill me. I'm popping in the clip when the wind blows. Every 20 seconds got me peeping out my window, investigating a joint for traps, taking my telephone for text. I'm staring at the woman on the corner. It's fucked up when your mind is playing tricks on you.
As Ellison so powerfully puts, not as a way of just settling into pain, but as a way of transcending it. And hip-hop, as its best, is an expression of that very quality through the soothing nature of rhythm and rhyme, through the expressive capacity of wordplay, through the ability to make the familiar unfamiliar, whether what's familiar to you is the Queensbridge Projects, or what's familiar to you is gang violence, whether what's familiar to you is a college dorm, whatever it is that is your particular form of limitation. It's a way of transcending circumstance to achieve a level of elevation, of lyrical elevation. Mm. It's a powerful, powerful thing that music can do.
What's to say about the generations of art here and politics? Jesse Jackson's, for example, reaction to Barack Obama. Why do people dislike Obama? What is the threat to an older generation?
Part of it probably is in that sense of swagger that we talked about earlier, the confidence with which Barack Obama carries himself, and the fluency that he brings, cultural fluency across racial lines. I think that's very threatening to traditional black leadership that has consolidated its power out of a politics of difference. You know, this you listen to Barack Obama's speeches from 2004 and up, and you hear consistently the drumbeat of the common good, the drumbeat of a broad understanding of American race. To those of us who study issues of race and culture, there are moments that are somewhat challenging in Barack Obama's politics, because I remember listening to his great speech from Philadelphia, and one of the things that was troubling about it, though, was that for every mention that he would give for every bow he would give to the effects of white supremacy upon blacks, and the distorting effect that that's had upon black possibility, he would also give an equal but opposite response to the challenges that white Americans have faced, or that Americans of other races have faced. So this dogged, transracialism that he brings. I'm not going to say post-racial, because I think he's very much someone who takes us deeper into race rather than away from it. Mm-hmm. That said, the way that he brings us to issues of race defies some of the ideas of the racial binary of black and white that a lot of black political figures over the last several generations have used to consolidate power. That's his threat, and that's maybe also a place where we can see him picking up with hip-hop, a movement that has on it a clear association with black identity, but that from its birth was multiracial, was about community across racial lines, the Latinos and the white hipsters in lower Manhattan coming together with hip hoppers to create this new form. I mean, there's out of that this kind of new American reality, that America's only catching up to hip hop in that regard. We're just starting to catch up to where hip hop's already been, I believe. And Barack Obama, you know, manifests that. I mean, Jay-Z has this line on the track that you mentioned earlier about his My President is Black DC remix. He says, "My president is black. In fact, he's half white. So even in a racist mind, he's half right. So if you got a racist mind, it's all right. My president is black, but his house is all white." And there's so much joy in that, so much just, and yet there's so much also behind that correction that Jay-Z gives to Young Jeezy's line of "My president is black," adding that, and yet he's the half white element is so fundamental to understanding how Obama works.
My president is black, my Maybach too, and I'll be goddamn if my diamonds ain't blue. My money's dark green and my Porsche is light gray. I'm headed for DC. Anybody feel me? My president is black, my Maybach too, and I'll be goddamn if my diamonds ain't blue. My money's dark green and my Porsche is light gray. I'm headed for DC. Anybody feel me? My president is black, in fact, he's half white. So even in a racist mind, he's half right. If you have a racist mind, you be aight. My president is black, but his house is all white. Rosa Parks sat so Martin Luther could walk. Martin Luther walked so Barack Obama could run. Barack Obama ran so all the children could fly. So I'ma spread my wings, you can meet me in the sky. I already got my own clothes, already got my own shoes. I was high before Barack, imagine what I'm going to. Hello, Miss America, hey, pretty lady. Red, white, and blue flag, wave for me, baby. Never thought I'd say this shit, baby, I'm good. You can keep your puss, I don't want no more push. No more war, no more rag, no more white lies. The president is black, my president is black, my Maybach too. And I'll be goddamn if my diamonds ain't blue. My money's dark green and my Porsche is light gray. I'm headed for DC, anybody feel me? My president is black, my Maybach too. And I'll be goddamn if my diamonds ain't blue. My money's dark green and my Porsche's light gray. I'm headed for DC. Anybody feel me?
You know, a lot of people, Shelby Steele in particular, have thought about Obama as this kind of, I think he uses the term bargainer, like he's a Bill Cosby, or better yet, a Heathcliff Huxtable for American politics in the 21st century, someone who is identifiably black and yet curries favor with whites, or at least makes them comfortable and unburdens them of some of their sense of guilt. This is Steele's thesis, as I understand it, that Obama fits that role. But I think he's missing some of what Obama does and what Obama can do, in part because of his biraciality. There's a way that he has the capacity to bridge the divide, not in some sort of artificial way of placation, but as a genuine embodiment of himself, because he's already had to do that in his own life, in his own personality. Ellison has that phrase, a completion of personality. To me, what we've seen, and it's, we are able to witness it in Obama's books, in his wonderful, wonderful memoir in particular, Dreams of My Father, we see this completion of personality taking shape. We see a child of mixed racial origins with a lot of disconnections, particularly with the Black and African side of his identity, nonetheless finding his way, stumbling his way toward a sense of wholeness. And maybe, just maybe, he could help this country do the same thing.
Adam Bradley, let there be no doubt, I think you're on to the real complexities of a deep, deep subject. Thank you.
Thank you, Chris. It's been a lot of fun.
Paul McCarthy edited this conversation with Adam Bradley. Our intern at Brown University, Hannah Olson, helped produce it. Citizens and rebels out there in Hip Hop Nation, feedback on this fit of politics and culture, this interplay of rap and reality, at our website, radioopensource.org. I'm Christopher Lighton. Thank you for being part of the conversation.